Who would have thought that a primitive document that is at least 3,000 years old, maybe older, born in a culture that came out of the backwaters of the Mediterranean world, a culture that the educated, influential, literate world hardly even noticed, would end up being a football kicked around the culture battles of the most advanced technological society on the face of the earth. Who would have thought? Yet, a battle over the posting of the Ten Commandments on courthouse lawns or in public school classrooms has raged off and on over the past at least 10 years. One Kentucky lawyer trying to convince the Supreme Court that the Ten Commandments were minimally about God and hardly mentions God and therefore are not really religious, prompted Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg to ask if he had actually read the first four, the first of which begins, "I am the Lord your God, you shall have no other gods before me." And when the Supreme Court finally handed down their decision on the display of public monuments of the Ten Commandments in Kentucky and Texas, the nine justices produced 10 opinions. Sounds like a Baptist church. On the extreme right wing of this debate are organizations such as the Society for the Practical Establishment and Perpetuation of the Ten Commandments, whose purpose includes doing away with the United States Constitution and the Bill of Rights and replacing it with the Ten Commandments. And while they're at it, they promote the death penalty for all murder, adultery, and homosexuality, a position that does seem to contradict the Sixth Commandment, but let's not be picky. Thomas Cahill, who has written a wonderful book entitled The Gifts of the Jews, makes the remarkable statement that there is no document in all the literatures of the world that is quite like the Ten Commandments. He goes on to explain that other cultures do have similar ethical guidelines, for sure, but there is a difference. They are always offered in a legal framework. That is to say, if you do such and such, this will be the consequence. That is not the case with the Ten Commandments. Neither are they what we might call the Martha Stewart list of 10 ways to make life happier and healthier. You know, the Ten Commandments are not a case of God looking at humanity and saying something like, "I do wish you would get your act together. Why aren't you eating silky braised chicken with your pearl onions and mushrooms for lunch? Where is your collection of Venetian hand-painted glass? And while you're at it, where did you pick up all those extra pounds?" It's not like that. So let us pause for a few moments to consider what really is so special about this document, this ancient document that we call the Ten Commandments. What has made them remain alive and active and well through all these centuries? Here in this document, for the first time in history, human beings were offered a code without justification or elaboration. In fact, biblical scholars think that they were originally just 10 Hebrew words, each commandment made up of one word. One word meaning no kill, no adultery. That way, illiterate people in the desert could memorize them. 10 words that still speak in the 21st century. They are not propositions for debate. They are not suggestions for happier living. They're not even challenges. They're just what they seem to be. And they have been received and accepted as scripture by three great world religions: Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Yes, Islam also considers the Ten Commandments to be holy scripture. And they have been accepted by billions of non-religious people as reasonable and necessary and even unalterable, because they come from what Cahill poetically describes as the deep silence that each of us carries within. But what do they mean? How can they bend and flex for every age and every culture? Take the prohibition on killing, for example. Those who howl the loudest about public displays of the Ten Commandments are frequently the very ones who call the loudest for capital punishment or for the carpet bombing of an enemy. So how do we bend and shape the commandment about not killing to justify what obviously is killing? Commandment 6 is a challenge for every generation. Those and other obvious questions are not easily answered. Yet, we know deep down in our hearts, that there is something fundamentally right about the commandment. We just don't always know how to apply it. And what about the slow, unnoticed destruction of human life among those not powerful enough to defend themselves? If poverty kills as we know it does, then are we breaking the sixth commandment when we fail to support jobs programs? Are drug companies guilty of breaking the sixth commandment when they choose not to produce a life-saving drug because it will not turn a profit? There's more than one way to kill, as we all recognize. If the divine principle behind this commandment is that all human life is precious, then we live out this commandment by supporting laws and public policy that enhance and protect the most human life and support the highest quality of life for the most people. That is always a very complex issue that is not easily reduced to a bumper sticker. Now perhaps we should slow down and take a deep breath, because we're getting into some deep water here. But one thing is not so deep. Through all the centuries since Jesus, the Ten Commandments have been most often used to instruct new Christians at the time of their baptism. In fact, some of the oldest baptismal liturgies ever discovered have the believer being baptized at sunrise, coming up out of the water of baptism and facing east, the direction of the rising sun, and reciting none other than the Ten Commandments and the commandments Jesus gave in the New Testament, to love the Lord your God and to love your neighbor. Think of that. At the dawn of a new day in the life of a believer, the very first words spoken are the words of the Decalogue. Why? Because like the children of Israel coming through the waters of the Red Sea and receiving the Ten Commandments, the new Christian comes up out of the waters of baptism and pledges allegiance to a vision of reality and ethical living rooted in God's radical policy and deeply at odds with the dominant culture. When a new Christian is baptized, she realizes that she has done nothing to deserve this act of God's grace. She is raised to new life because of something God has done, not anything she has done. And when we take communion, we are being given new life, not because of anything we have done, not because we deserve it, but because of something Christ has done for us. This is precisely what struck John Newton, the slave ship captain, who was converted and wrote the hymn Amazing Grace. He was only too aware of what he had done, and there was absolutely nothing he could do to change the fact that he had caused misery and death as the captain of a slave ship. The pain and death caused by that infamous middle passage had been part of the economic system, you could say. But he knew that he had cooperated in an evil system. No amount of saying he was sorry or just doing his job could atone for that. He could never make it up. Then he experienced the amazing grace of God. We might cringe at the 18th century language that he used to describe himself as a wretch. But if you had been the captain of a slave ship, maybe wretch would be too tame a word. And yet, every one of us can identify with that classic line, through many dangers, toils, and snares I have already come. 'Tis grace has brought me safe thus far, and grace will lead me home. The church has always agreed with our Jewish neighbors that the Ten Commandments are not a burden, they are sheer grace. The Ten Commandments are a gift from God to a world in desperate need of those 10 words. Those 10 words, along with the presence of Christ, can lead us through many dangers, toils, and snares, and they can lead us home. And where is home? You know where home is. Home is the place that lives out the grace of God and accepts you just the way you are. Home is the place where you can make mistakes and still be loved. Home is the place where you can break every commandment in the book and still be forgiven. Home is the place where, as Robert Frost famously said, they have to take you in. I want to remind you that this church is just such a place. To paraphrase that familiar line that I think came from Dan Ivins, we reserve the right to accept anybody. Whatever dangers, toils, or snares you may face, you can face them with a church family like this who will support you and pray for you and love you. This week, I received a moving email from a good friend of mine named Mitch Carnell, who is a member of the First Baptist Church of Charleston, South Carolina. A church like this one, with a long, distinguished history. It was the First Baptist Church founded in the South. Here's what Mitch wrote to me and several others. And I'm quoting from his email. October 6, 2014. Is that tomorrow or today? That's tomorrow, isn't it? October 6, 2014 is my 50th anniversary as a member of the First Baptist Church of Charleston. Although these 50 years have not been without heartbreak and pain, my family and I found a home. This is a loving, supportive church family. I have nothing but gratitude for the people of First Baptist and thanksgiving for the spiritual nourishment I have found here. Many of you can say exactly the same thing about this church, or if you are a visitor, possibly from a church you have come from. You're part of a family. And families gather. Families laugh and cry together. Families tell stories. And oh, how families eat. How they eat. So let's be family today. Wherever you are from, you are part of this family today. It's dinner time. Time to eat. Time to be thankful. Time to remember amazing grace.